it's still word of mouth that is the number one source of information in a local community for healthcare. But when we want to talk about quality and outcomes, which is at least half of what we should be worried about, it ain't there.
Diagnosed with cancer and told she had 6 months to live, Jane Saracen Khan's mother, Polly, had no internet to consult. Rather, armed with a friendly doctor and sympathetic librarian, she educated herself to 7 more years of life. She was the prototypical healthcare consumer before the concept existed, and she was Jane's inspiration.
This is Tectonics, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health. I'm David Chewitz.
And I'm Lisa Soonan. Everyone who meets Jane Saracen Khan falls in love with her for her candor, her intellect, and her joyful approach to life and work. Jane marries her background in healthcare economics with a fundamental understanding of healthcare consumerism. She helps some of the country's great companies figure out what people really want from the healthcare world. We're so excited to have you here today, Jane, on Tectonics. And hoping that you could start by telling us, what exactly is a healthcare consumer anyway, and why is that such an important concept?
Well, David and Lisa, I'm delighted to spend this time with you, so thanks for the invitation. What's a healthcare consumer? Well, nobody really wants to consume healthcare, but everybody wants to be healthy. So for many years, under a patriarchal health financing system through third-party insurance, nobody really had to be a healthcare consumer because decisions were made for people enrolled in health plans. But increasingly, most of us are taking on more cost and more clinical responsibility for decisions, whether it's for taking a new drug or finding a new doctor because we're so mobile and we move all the time. So increasingly, people and caregivers and parents and aging adults with even aging parents have to become consumers and figure out what things are available that they might need, what stuff costs, and how much of that cost they're going to bear. So while a lot of people on my Twitter feed and LinkedIn will dialogue with me over the past few years, what are you talking about? Nobody's really a consumer. The fact is we have to be consumers, even though we might not like the idea of all of this. This is the role that's been thrust on us due to payment and employers shifting more responsibility to people.
So do people really want to experience the healthcare system the way they experience Amazon or Target or whatever other consumer interaction they may have?
Yeah, I think people are morphing into healthcare consumers based on what they're learning from DIYing the rest of their life. So we all have taken on the mantle of being what EY, the new Ernst & Young, last year termed homo informaticus in a report they did on being multi-channel consumers. And homo informaticus is really all of us who are multi-channel. We consume information on the phone, on computers, from television, live streaming, streaming with other kinds of mobile devices. And we're information hungry, whether that's with video, data, pictures, whatever that is. So as homo informaticus in other parts of our life, whether it's going to OpenTable to find a dinner reservation like I did earlier today, or making airplane reservations like I did earlier today for the nonstop travel, etc., we're all, or my daughter is just ordered stuff from Graze, an online subscription service for snacks, which your daughter Maddie might want to subscribe to. All this is this digital lifestyle. And it's morphing over into health and healthcare. And a lot of us are asking, why aren't health and healthcare as easy to book, to pay for, to consume as these other services are in other parts of our life? And that's what's really driving a lot of, from the grassroots, from the ground, demand pushing up on the legacy health system,
so do you,
health providers, and plans.
So, Jane, do you see this demand that you're describing as, you know, people, the famous quote about the future's here, but it's not evenly distributed. How do you see that in this context? Because on the one hand, my feeling is that there are people who are exactly like you're describing, want all the information or demanding to be healthcare consumers. But I wonder if, particularly out here in the Valley, we may be underestimating the number of people who actually feel grateful not to have to shop for healthcare the way they shop for everything, or at least who would prefer to do it not that way, and who like the idea of, in a sense, having one less thing to think about and to be able to put some measure of trust in the healthcare system.
Mm-hmm. There is this concept now about the paradox of choice. So as an economist, I follow a lot of that kind of literature that's coming out of academia and the business book section of the New York Times bestseller list. So too much choice is paralyzing as well, and we get into analysis paralysis, or it's just too overwhelming. And in healthcare, that can be the case. So what we want to have is this balance between just enough choice for our own taste. And increasingly, based on the kinds of analytics that Amazon does when it serves up book titles that we might like, or other services serve up things we might like based on past experiences, past purchases, past consumption, we're entering
like
that era.
You had an appendectomy. You may enjoy a colonoscopy.
But you might enjoy this doctor versus another doctor. You know, now that Yelp is partnering with ProPublica and working with that data set that they have for Medicare and other places. So as we enter that world of data analytics, David and Lisa, I think we'll be able to serve up choices for people that make sense based on people's past behaviors.
So you talked about being a healthcare economist. I think that's how you mostly promote yourself, really. Mm. And, you know, there's that old joke that if you put 10 economists in a room, you'll get 11 different explanations of what's going on in the economy.
I thought that was a joke about Israelis.
Yeah, that too. But in healthcare, I think you might actually get 15 opinions. How do you define being a health economist anyway? What role do you play with respect to that?
Well, there are lots of health economists who do, and they do different things. So there are the great academics who inspired me, Uwe Reinhardt, for example. And Milton Friedman, even, he wasn't a health economist, he was an economist, but in the early days of my education, I was reading all about like libertarian economics and the freedom of choice and how I figured out, well, nothing's really free, and he coined that there's no such thing as a free lunch. Somebody's got to pay for that lunch. So, you know, those were sort of early inspirations. My kind of health economics is microeconomics, the economics of the household and the family and the economics of women. So when you study economics in graduate school, you have to figure out what slice of the economy and what lens you want to do. You want to take on. So there's macroeconomics, which is the national economy, the GDP and employment and taxes. That bored the heck out of me. What I liked was putting the microscope onto the family, the economics of the household and productivity and the economics of children. And those were the economics that were researched by Gary Becker out of the University of Chicago, who studied the microeconomics of the family, the household, and women. So he ultimately won the Nobel Prize. And he was discovering
that there were women, maybe?
Yeah. And that women who didn't work outside the household had an economic value. So that kind of work is now being done at, you know, Deloitte, who's been calculating what's the value of caregiving in the home. Because it has a huge economic value, which health plans now have to start to recognize unless they want, you know, grandma to end up in a nursing home. So increasingly we're going to find health plans compensating in some way or recognizing and incentivizing caregivers to keep on caregiving.
You wrote a great piece yesterday, which is August, I don't know which day it was, but anyways, I think it was August 11th in the Huffington Post about your mom and how she was, you know, sort of the prototypical healthcare consumer, you know, somebody who, despite, you know, the illiquidity of information at the time that she was sick, figured out a way. Is that what got you here?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was very young when she was diagnosed back in 71. And when you had her rare form of of leukemia that she was diagnosed with back then. It was a very medieval treatment. There was no chemo or anything. So it was blood transfusions and very unspecific radiation. In any case, though, with a lot of input from community and her social network, which was all offline, of course, no internet back in 71 to 79, and a lot of love and information and partnering with various doctors, and eating really smartly, reading the books of Adele Davis, who wrote things like Let's Eat Right to Get Fit. These were really early days. But she figured out and she project managed her way to being pretty healthy for 7 years and had a bad last 2 years, but still outwitted Wayne State University Medical School in Detroit by 7 years. So good for her. In any case, yes, she was my inspiration, and particularly the last 13 days of her life in hospital when, as a very young economics student at the University of Michigan, I read those EOBs, the Explanations of Benefits, and saw that our family, my dad, was only responsible for the phone and the television set. Literally every dollar charged in the last 13 days of life, which were pretty heroic interventions, unfortunately, which she did not want, by the way, but no great hospice program back then. It cost over $130,000, about $10,000 a day in 79. I can't even tell you how much money that is valued at today. And so I started to think about, what the heck? Who's paying for this? Because Daddy wasn't. And my family lived the same lifestyle after she died than before. So I started to learn about the health insurance system, Blue Cross of Michigan, where I was living as a young student at that time, and knew there was something in this for me. So I went back to University of Michigan to do my graduate degrees, and there you have it. But, yeah, she inspired me both in terms of that light bulb moment and then ongoing just as that chief household officer role model that she was.
Are you seeing the emergence? I mean, I know we've talked about, you and I, and spoken about the emergence of this role, this chief household, this chief health officer of the home being the woman. Do you think that this is becoming more widely recognized, or is this still, you know, one of the great kept secrets of healthcare?
Well, based on my portfolio of work as a consultant, I'd say a good third of my clients now are using my intellectual capital and energy to focus on the role of the woman in health, whether it's with a big food company I'm working with, a digital health company, or a health plan. Three big projects with big global companies, one European, two American, all focusing on what is it about the woman's role in that home family unit that influences healthcare decision making, healthcare consumption, health literacy. And so I could see it with my own practice, my own consulting business shifting in that direction as well. And it started actually with a European client before it started to morph into the U.S. Europe's been looking at this for a lot longer than American companies, interestingly enough.
Part of what makes people empowered customers or consumers is having the information they need to make decisions. I feel like there's a complete imbalance between the amount people talk about data and freeing the data and data availability and what they actually have available to make decisions, particularly, you know, under trying circumstances, but even the people you're talking about for a household under any circumstances. How have you seen that evolve in the last several years, the availability of information to make intelligent choices?
It's still such a mess, David, chaotic and really heavy lifting for that chief household officer, whether it's a mom or a dad, a man or a woman, doesn't matter what kind of consumer we're talking about. There's a lot of data, but no information, and that's why we still see in the surveys, whether it's with Edelman or other communications companies and consumer goods companies I work with, it's still word of mouth that is the number one source of information in a local community for health care. It really sucks because word of mouth is great in terms of certain aspects in health, bedside manner, exam side manner, good magazines in the waiting room and parking. But when we want to talk about quality and outcomes, which is at least half of what we should be worried about, it ain't there. And, you know, Castlight has blown through, what, over $100 million or more, and others who are trying to get this, serve up this kind of information. So we still talk about it a lot. I think we're getting there. And I think if we have this talk even a year from now, there'll be a couple of vendors who will have gotten at least to a decent place in some communities. But it's still very fragmented.
Why is it so hard? I mean, you know, I guess part of the dilemma here is, you know, there have been people like, you know, Professor Herslinger at Harvard for a while. I had to work in a Harvard reference specifically for Lisa.
Yeah, thank you, David.
I was
worried you wouldn't say Harvard reference.
I knew it. No, it's Harvard Day here. Every day is Harvard Day. But she's been advocating for really talking about sort of the idea of sort of consumer empowerment as really a way to that if healthcare was really truly a market, and if things were then you would inordinately empower the consumers. Why is that so hard to transform it into a market? Is it? I mean, it has to be because the incumbents are just resisting the change. How come as more of the financial responsibility, as you're pointing out, you know, high deductibles, is really turning to the families, to the participants. How come that's not more rapidly driving the evolution to more of a true healthcare market?
Mm-hmm. If we look at these legacy players, doctors and hospitals and health plans, they haven't served up retail. In a retail environment, you know, since before Marcus Welby, really since the 40s. And then, you know, when the war came, World War II happened, was the beginning of the evolution of health insurance as we know it today. And that's just such an artificial legacy now that, unfortunately, incentives have been developed over these years so that everybody's responding quite rationally, pharma, hospitals, doctors, to the financial incentives that have grown up around this industry. And it's been so hard, that's why it's been so hard to break, because if it's a whack-a-mole game. If you press down as we did in the 80s, inpatient surgery and move things to ambulatory surgery. What happened? We grew all these ambulatory surgery centers and upped the utilization of them so that it became a zero-sum game. We moved it from one setting to another, increased the volume, and there was still money to be made. So until we get to this bundled payment kind of arrangement, paying for value, which we talk about a lot, and in some markets it's moving faster than others, that can help get us to a Regina Herzlinger world, while these new entrants, like the Castlights of the world, Health Grades, which has been around for years, but still doesn't have exactly what people are looking for, though they are working hard to get there.
Where do they miss? You don't have to pick a specific company, but where do these companies tend to miss? What are they, you know, how is their solution not the actual problem?
I won't talk to Castlight necessarily, but, or Health Grades, as you say, not a single company. But the way we're able to look at retail data, like the way we buy cars and Consumer Reports or washing machines, this is how people have learned to shop for capital goods and white goods in their homes, cars, washing machines, that sort of thing. People would spend more time seeking that kind of information if it was that simple, if you could have a very simple way to understand this is a good experience, this was a not so good experience, on a scale of, you know, happy face, sad face, whatever.
But how much of it is the problem that that medicine hasn't been sort of condensed that way in a, you know, sort of for consumer evaluation, and how much of it is that it's not, there might be something off about that model where trying to, you know, to describe what it's like to, you know, to have a very personalized illness or to try to seek care, there are parts of it that seem, you know, where you can have ratings like sort of Yelp style, but then there are parts of it where I wonder about the analogy. I wonder if part of the issue is in expecting a physician evaluation to be like the way Consumer Reports is going to value an automobile.
I saw a funny example on TV, I was watching the show Parenthood. Yeah. And one of the characters on the show got cancer, and she was.
That sounds pretty funny. I can see why.
It was hilarious. She was shopping for a doctor.
Yeah.
And the first doctor she interviewed was clearly scientifically more up to date, but he was a total asshole. And the other doctor she talked to was probably not so savvy, but was super sweet and nice and supportive and female, which was interesting. The first was male, second was female, and in the end, despite all of her family trying to pressure her to select the female doctor because it would be kinder and gentler, she picked the asshole, smarter doctor. And I thought it was so interesting because I think in real life it would have gone the other way.
Mm-hmm. I've seen it in personal life with friends now sadly going through things like multiple myeloma and some pretty serious things where when it comes down to it, the sicker you are, the more it seems you'll go for the more serious doctor who might not have a great bedside manner, but have the published articles and the experience. And I think everybody, one of the deficits in learning for consumers is the understanding of how to look at risk in your life. And that's one of the responsibilities we have to try to help people understand and intuit a little better in the United States is everything has risks. This includes things like prescription drugs, which, you know, we can talk later about Kardashian and the risk language being avoided and all that. But the fact of the matter is there's risks in everything we do in healthcare. So that also is part of the issue that we need to talk more transparently about, whether it's risk for a procedure or taking a new drug or any number of things. So, David, I think there is a way to divine these different aspects of quality, value, price, and then the softer side of things. If you go to Pocket Doc, there are videos of doctors talking so people can get a sense of what a clinician is like in terms of a personality, and then combined with a strike price, almost like an auction, combined with a map, and lots of different pieces of data in one place. The more we can put these different data pieces together, qualitative, quantitative, visual, data, graphic, all of that will help different kinds of consumers who are visual learners versus data learners versus aural through the ear learners be able to make better decisions in that rich media contextual environment. So that's why I say that we're getting closer to being able to do that.
So speaking of that media-rich environment and Kim Kardashian that you brought up, I'm so fascinated by the blurring of the entertainment world and the products world, just like it's happened in kind of every other segment of the economy. And mm-hmm. you see movies with all product placement and all that. And then this last week in August, early August, there was an incident where Kim Kardashian, who's pregnant and apparently very nauseous, although she may not realize she's nauseous because she's married to Kanye West. I'm not sure. It might be a pregnancy. that she took a drug, a drug that prevents morning sickness, and she wrote an Instagram post about it.
Well, starting off, she started being on the medicine, and then the company heard she was on the medicine,
right,
and then they hired
her,
and then subsequent
to that. And she wrote a post about the quality, the positive quality of the drug and how much it helped her. And then the FDA came down hard on the company that sponsored the drug and on her for promoting the product and talking about it as a consumer without listing the risks, as you have to do in FDA approved marketing.
And if that question isn't hard enough, you can consider putting it in the context of the recent free speech ruling by the Supreme Court.
Discuss. What do you think?
Discuss
about
amongst yourselves.
There seems to be such a big disconnect in the industry about what is the legitimate use of social media for healthcare consumerism, at least when pharma is involved.
Mm-hmm. So I've been involved in with DTC, direct-to-consumer promotion and pharma, going way back to 2003. And back then, I was working with one of the big drug companies, who's a little smaller today than it used to be, with their HIV/AIDS franchise. And this was Magic Johnson and Combivir. Now, we didn't have Twitter back then, of course. But Magic Johnson used to go on a variety of talk shows and talk a lot about HIV, and everyone knew he was a paid spokesman for this drug, and a great spokesman because he was living well, he was living healthy, he was married, he had kids, and for many years, you know, at least 20 years now, we've had various celebrity spokespeople in the two-dimensional, the 1.0 communications world, TV, broadcasting, right. Bob Dole with Viagra, Sally Field with Boniva, etc. Now all of a sudden we add the Health 2.0 lens to this, social media, and we all know, and we're on this podcast, so we're on a 2.0 world here going back and forth, that when there's social media involved, it's not just a push the message world, it's a push and pull and a dialogue, and you end up with a lot of unintended consequences sometime. But that doesn't mean drug companies can't use Twitter well. It's just in this case, Kim hadn't been well schooled in the FDA fair balance rules, because other pharmas have used various celebrity spokespeople on Twitter in the last few years, and it's gone fairly well. You haven't had a kind of breach like this. So, you know, I don't think it's not usable, but in this case, it was way over the top.
All right, well, let me just ask you about the way over the top business, because you can imagine another perspective where here's this person, a citizen, she's describing how much she likes a product. She does it 1 week, and it's like, fine, that's how the company even heard of her. She says more or less the same thing, hypothetically, the following week, and then it's sort of like, oh my God, they're going to, you know, here's a firing squad for her and the company. I'm just sort of wondering what's the right lens through which to think about this.
Well, the FDA, you know, is all over this. And pharma, you know, some pharma's lawyer, it's all about the lawyers in the right. Pharma companies. I've worked with some that are extremely open. A good example, because we want people to know where this has been done right, is this race car driver with type 1 diabetes. Charlie Kimball is his name. Okay. I don't know how I pulled that out of my head.
That's impressive.
Charlie Kimball has type 1 diabetes, and he's been using Novo Nordisk, is the company, their insulin since, I don't know, the mid-2000s, I'll say. And anyway, he tweets using @racewithinsulin. That has gone really well, that campaign. The FDA has not come down on it negatively at all, and they've been able to balance things, linking to a web page. All this has to be very carefully orchestrated in a multimedia way, and many pharma companies are terribly siloed when it comes to, and their ad agencies are largely at fault for this, because they don't do well in this multi-platform, multi-channel world. It's a very artful thing to be able to pull this off. And I think Novo is a company you can look at who's figured this out. Now, maybe because they're a one-condition company, they're all about diabetes, that they've got the resources and the scale to figure this out. But it can be done. It should be done. This is how people live every day.
But you know what? I just wonder. I just wonder about if it was a calculated risk almost to a certain extent, because they've had more publicity. Mm-hmm. They had 500,000 impressions just from her Instagram, apparently, or something
right.
like that. But the publicity about the story of screwing it up has probably given them millions and millions of impressions around the drug that they never would have gotten. You just got to wonder at what level, maybe it was a calculated risk.
Yeah, the company, I will tell you that the company, which is called Duchesne, if that's how you pronounce it, they
it's a family-friendly show, so we'll go with that.
Well, they got a letter from the FDA when they first got approved for the drug in
right.
November 2013, when they didn't even talk about some risk information in their announcement. So that company's been living on the edge on this for a while. And if they thought this was a calculated risk, two times, the FDA, I think, will definitely crack. Be watching them really closely. Let's put it that way.
Meanwhile,
a third time,
make a bunch
who knows?
Of money. So, Jane, you work across every stakeholder group, right? Pharma,
yeah.
and providers, and payers, and consumer companies that are consumer products, grocery, whatever. Do any of them, let me ask it a different way, have any of them jumped out in the lead to be really smart about this healthcare consumer stuff? Which of these sectors has got it more figured out?
So the very interesting data point came out of a study last October or November from Strategy Ann, which was the old Booz,
right.
Now part of PwC. And I've been quoting this study a lot. You've probably seen in one or more of my blogs or talks. And the data point is this. When U.S. consumers were asked, what kinds of organizations do you trust to help you manage your health? 39% of people said, I trust healthcare providers. 40% of people said, I trust big retail. And 39% said, I trust digitally enabled companies. So let me say this again. Roughly 40% of people equally trust retail, healthcare providers, and digitally enabled companies. So that's Apple, Google, Samsung, Microsoft, Amazon, Uber, blah, blah, blah. So isn't this fascinating that in 2014, consumers are saying the healthcare providers, and this was another part of the survey, the healthcare providers weren't providing the kind of transparency on price and value for a product or service that a retailer provides and a digital company provides. So the point here is that consumers are looking to these new entrants for that kind of level of service, transparency, support for health.
That kind of survey, though, is that like when they survey, people, do you like Congress? Oh, I hate Congress. What about your congressperson? Oh, no, that person's really good. And like, oh, medicine. Oh, I hate doctors. What about your doctor? Oh, well, I really like my doctor. I listen to this and I can, and say, well, maybe that's plausible. But then on the other hand, you imagine someone sort of very sick and, they're not going to like, go to, whatever, Amazon or something. They're going to try to find, I would imagine, maybe I'm wrong, I guess it's sort of I imagine there's a distinction between how you respond to a survey.
Well, it's interesting that you say that because I had to go buy some product that I might recommend to my doctor.
She jabbed at me.
I jabbed at you.
You can't see this.
My doctor said, go to this, just medical distribution company and this and that and blah, blah, blah. And I ended up buying it on Amazon.
Wow.
Not going to the little medical distribution shitty little company up in wherever Northern Marin, that was a hassle for me, and that didn't look like it had been swept in a very long time.
But who gave you the advice to buy the product to begin with?
My doctor. So I believed I needed it at that point,
right.
And then it was a question of whether I was going to go trust that medical authority to buy it from, and I did end up buying it on Amazon where I could read reviews of multiple products. It was sort of interesting.
That is really interesting.
I wonder, Jane, if there's, we're winding down to the end here, but I'm wondering if there's one company from the consumer product side or the technology side that you think is going to be the breakout winner in healthcare. Who's going to look out 10 years, going to be the one?
Yeah, well, for me as an economist, when I look to at the mass market and mainstreaming health across all people, I grew up in Detroit, union family, so you can imagine where my politics and my sympathies are. I would look to Walmart to drive mass market health through their new care clinic model, which is now in 17 places, largely in the South. But this is a place where you can go now to get a physician checkup with an MD or a DO for $40. And if you work for Walmart, it's $4. So this is a kind of model we need to watch. Walmart, which also is trying to drive, and don't be too cynical about this, more healthy food through the front of the store as well. More organic, more fresh, and so I'm hopeful that for mass market, middle market people, we're going to see more retailers like that at good prices, as long as we're seeing electronic health records using standards. I won't get too wonky on the podcast, but there's a way to collect the information so that it gets to wherever your medical home is into your EHR from a place like that. So I'm hopeful that our retailers are going to play a huge role.
Well, I love that we've come full circle from the medical home being the home to medical home being possibly Walmart, which is probably a metaphor for something. But Jane, it's been great to talk to you today. Thank you so much for your time and for being here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you both. It was a joy.
Take care.